Welcome to the Issue Is podcast. I'm Alex Michaels, and this week, a lot of variety. We've got a debate between Tommy Lahren on the right and Ethan Bierman on the left. Then a conversation about Israel, October 7th, and where we go from here with Sheryl Sandberg, who just made a documentary about the topic. Then we head to the Project Angel Food Kitchen, where we catch up with Senator LaFonza Butler on the one-year anniversary of her being in office. And finally, a moment of fun, Stephen Colbert talking about our show. But let's start with an Issue Is debate. It's been too long since we've had one. Tommy Lahren is a veteran of some of our biggest debates. She's been on several times with Ethan Bierman in the past, and she's back with him this week to do the big debate, which is Trump versus Harris. We talk about abortion. We talk about immigration. We talk about January 6th and democracy and the VP debate. A lot of the biggest issues that people are talking about right now. Here's the extended version with a lot more content than we were able to fit on TV. It gets heated and it's fascinating, but it's also civil and kind of a reminder of what we need more of. So here's the debate. Joining us from her home studio in Nashville, Tennessee, our returning champion, Tommy Lahren. She is the host of Tommy Lahren is Fearless on OutKick and a Fox News and Fox News radio commentator. And here in studio is Ethan Bierman. Good to see you, Ethan. He, of course, is a attorney, the owner of the Bierman Law Firm and a professor at Loyola Law School. Ethan, Tommy, good to have both of you back with us. Welcome back to The Issue Is.
Thanks, Alex.
It's good to be here, Alex. And, you know, I feel for you guys in California. I'm happy to be in Tennessee. But I do miss seeing the both of you in person. I'm still glad I get to join you, though, because you know that although I don't like the way your state is run, I love a lot of the people in your state. So it's great to join you from Tennessee.
We'll take that. All right. Ladies first, let's start with you. The debate is Trump versus Harris. I think I know where you're going. Tommy, your case for voting for Donald Trump.
Right. Well, listen, Alex, I think it's pretty obvious how the American people should vote. And I'm sure Ethan and I can go back and forth with our own stats and our own jobs numbers. And, you know, that is all very important. But for me, as you know, Alex, I'm almost a single issue voter at this point. Immigration, or I should say the mass invasion, is really top of my mind, especially after this week when we learned that FEMA funds that cannot get us through hurricane season, but $640.9 million of that FEMA funding has been allocated to help state and local governments care for illegal immigrants. To me, that just tips the scales. And I think those few people out there that are still on the fence, they need to pay attention to this. The American economy and our American cities simply cannot take four more years of open borders, simply cannot take four more years of a Democrat in the White House. Kamala Harris will tell you that she's a new path forward, but the truth is she's been in office for almost 4 years. All these great things she talks about doing, she could be doing right now. So to me, it's pretty obvious. We want to move forward, but we also want to return back to the days of Donald Trump with prosperity and also national security and domestic security for all.
Ethan.
Well, of course, Tommy and I completely disagree. I think Kamala Harris is the clear and only choice on the ballot this year. At the top of the ticket, of course, but it's simple. The Biden economy, more jobs created than any other president since the Great Depression. And we have the issues of bodily autonomy for women, women's health care. The Republicans are doing everything in their power to restrict and remove the ability of women to protect themselves and their unborn children as needed, but themselves in particular. We also have issues like taxes. Should we just be giving everything away to the billionaire class? That's what Trump has promised yet again. Actually openly got caught selling out to the oil barons of the 21st century. And let's not forget Project 2025. Putting loyalists exclusively in the federal government is Trump's plan. That's not democracy, that's autocracy. Let's protect that democracy that we cherish so much.
Of course, Trump has said that he dismisses Project 2025 and that he's not going for that. So let's not get too deep into that, but let's talk about what he did. And Tommy, Ethan brings up the issue of abortions. We know you're pro-choice. This week we learned that Melania Trump is pro-choice. You say that you're a one-issue voter when it comes to immigration, but there's a lot of people out there that are one-issue voters when it comes to abortion rights. Does it not concern you what
has happened during the Trump administration when it comes to abortion rights.
So it certainly does not. And I say that as somebody who has been quite controversially more on the pro-choice side because I am for limited government. But I'll tell you this. This was reiterated, I thought, beautifully at the VP debate this week where J.D. Vance said and Donald Trump tweeted to solidify it that they will not sign a federal abortion ban. It is up to the states. Roe v. Wade was overturned. It was sent back to the states where the American people in each state have the ability to decide for themselves and for their state what they want to do on the abortion question. And there's going to be some states like California that are going to have unfettered and unlimited abortions. Good for you in California. There's going to be other states like mine here in Tennessee that are going to be more conservative. But at the end of the day, your voters get to decide that. And I know that Ethan's going to say, yes, women shouldn't have to travel for abortions. And I understand some of the horror stories and I sympathize with those. But if we're talking about this, I mean, I can tell you, I had to leave the great state of California because of policies that I didn't like. It's unfortunate that people have to choose based on the way their state votes if they want to live there or not. But that happens to be the reality of the situation. And if the will of the American people is a more pro-abortion or pro-choice stance, then the voters in those states will reflect that and the national conversation will move forward. So whereas I am a pro-choice conservative, I think that Donald Trump and J.D. Vance calmed a lot of fears on this issue this week. And I hope that Ethan can acknowledge that.
Well, I don't. And the reason why is because when you put it in the hands of the states, especially a thing like bodily autonomy, that's actually liberty of the women themselves that we're talking about. And when states like Texas actually try to hunt down people who not only seek abortions, but anybody who dare to help them leave the state, we have really serious national issues, not at a state level. Furthermore, the data is already clear in the red states that have restricted abortion. The infant mortality rate has climbed 13%, let alone what's happened to the women themselves who have suffered and some have died because of these new laws.
Last word on this topic to you, Tommy.
Listen, I think Ethan and I are probably closer personally on this issue than even our respective parties are. And I know that he has concerns and I understand the frustration. I really do, because obviously I am more on the pro-choice side, although I am personally pro-life. But I'll tell you this. Yes, these states that have restrictive bans, the Republicans are not doing well in these states and they're being rebuffed by the voters. And J.D. Vance brought that up with his own state of Ohio. I think that this is going to be a conversation that's going to go on for many, many years. And I think that you will see the states change based on the public opinion in those states. So whereas I don't believe in hunting people down or I don't believe in prosecuting doctors, I don't believe in any of that either. But I do believe that the states is where this issue belongs. And I also believe that the right has, to me, a more realistic approach than the left, which doesn't seemingly have any restrictions and believes that 9 months is okay for an abortion. So I understand that this is a heated topic. It's a big gray area. But I think the American people are going to have to sort this one out in their states.
Not everybody on the left believes that 9 months is okay for an abortion, but let's move, Tommy, to the issue that you brought up, which is immigration. And Ethan, we see polls reflecting that voters believe that Trump would be stronger on the issue of immigration. It's a huge concern for a lot of voters. Your take on that?
Well, I think it's very interesting that voters would think that about Donald Trump. So the family separation policy that actually we're still trying to recover from, where children were yanked from their parents' arms as they sought a better life in the United States, potentially fleeing the drug violence of Central America, among others. We absolutely agree that we have to secure our borders. We need to know who enters and exits our country from a national security perspective. But to say that Donald Trump will be any better is almost a joke, because his so-called wall has already failed endlessly where it was built. They immediately built ladders that climbed over the top. But furthermore, let's actually get to the key issue here. When Congress finally had something where there was bipartisan support, top Republicans were behind the bill, it was Donald Trump's cry that, oh, it will help Joe Biden, that got all the Republicans to vote against what was a rare occurrence of bipartisan support for a bill to actually address immigration. My concern is both parties benefit from making this a hot potato issue every single election, and any real solution never gets discussed.
Tommy.
Oh, boy. You know, Alex, there's so much I have to say on this. As somebody who's been to the border several times during both administrations, I have a lot, but I'm going to try to keep it brief and concise. Listen, there's no way around it. In 3.5 years, the Biden-Harris administration welcomed in 10 million plus illegal aliens. We know tens of thousands of them are convicted murderers and rapists. There are criminal aliens that are filling the ICE dockets that are non-detained. This is simply inexcusable. They have been overseeing this administration. Now, listen, I know it's easy to point to a talking point saying the bipartisan border bill. That really wasn't a border bill at all. It was a foreign aid bill disguised as a border bill. It normalized 1.8 million illegal aliens into this country per year. Now, if you're okay with that, then that's another discussion. But a lot of Americans are not okay with normalizing and codifying an invasion at our southern border. It afforded lawyers to illegal immigrants. I've had several attorneys like Ethan on my show that specialize in immigration, and they say, listen, once you start affording these people immigration attorneys, any good immigration attorney is going to stretch this process out 5-10 years. By that time, these illegal aliens have already had multiple children, and it's almost impossible to remove them from this country. The bipartisan border bill, I understand it's a great talking point for the left, but it would not have solved anything, and it would not have done anything with the 10 million plus. There was no deportation guidance in that border bill. So the majority of Americans support mass deportation, over 50%. It's time to start dealing with the problem. I know that the Democrats just want to fast track these people to citizenship and voting rights, but the majority of the American people, they don't want to see that happen.
I mean, I have to speak up just for a second, Alex. If you're going to mass deport over 10 million people, rounding them up and shipping them out, first off, that is horrific from a human rights perspective. But more importantly, it ignores the economic impact. There's a reason that prior Republican administrations, such as George W. Bush, were pro-immigration. It's because the big business, the donors behind many politicians in both parties, benefits from having lower cost labor that Americans won't do. Remember that there was an effort in places like Florida to get Americans to take the job. They jacked the wage up and Americans wouldn't do the work. They couldn't do the work. Many of these jobs are not something that Americans want to do. What's important, to Tommy's point, is that we need a functioning visa system for people to come here and work. It used to be called the Bracero system, and that did work for a period of time, but we need something to keep track of people who are coming and going and to have the labor that is needed to get the jobs done.
Well, one thing is clear. Both parties have not really wanted to solve this issue. When Democrats had complete control of Washington, they didn't move an immigration bill. When Republicans had complete control of Washington, they didn't move an immigration bill, in part because donors and activists on both sides have tried to stop it. Tommy, if Trump actually gets in there, do you think that there's going to be a real change?
Well, I believe, to Ethan's point about the mass deportations, it's always interesting to me when those on the liberal side clutch their pearls about deporting people that came to our country illegally, but they completely dismiss what these people and their impact on communities. Now, listen, I do believe that a lot of these people are good people, that are families that are fleeing countries that are far worse than ours, and I understand that. And I don't blame them for coming to our country if given a free pass. But the fact of the matter is, our cities and our states simply cannot handle the load of millions and millions of illegal aliens in their communities. It is bankrupting New York City. It is bankrupting Denver, Colorado. And that needs to be dealt with. So while I understand it's not going to look nice to have deportations, the American people and our country simply cannot sustain and maintain what is currently happening. And if you want to talk about wages, when you pump millions of illegal aliens and you give them work authorization, all you're doing is driving down wages for the American people. That is something that you also have to contend with. There's also limited housing. Right now, you've got cities that are paying for hotel rooms. They're paying for debit cards. They're paying for meals. They're paying for every whim and wish of illegal aliens. And that's simply unacceptable when you have American people that are currently struggling, especially in the Southeast right now. $750? I mean, come on, Ethan.
And Ethan, it is objectively true that our cities and counties are overrun by a lot of the demands of this.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't use the word overrun, but I might say in certain cases.
Overwhelmed?
Yes, overwhelmed, I think, is the more appropriate term. But here, look, there's no question that a pure open borders policy, whether it's from the libertarians or the progressive left, is not the way to do things. We need to know who's coming and going. We need to have better control. We need to have, I say the phrase, functioning work visa programs. There are visa programs. They're not functioning. There are certain labor needs in both the hospitality industry, in the agricultural industry, among others, where we absolutely need to have some other form of labor coming in to help out. But nobody, to Alex's point, and as I said earlier, neither party ever bothers dealing with that because it's way more effective for a politician to be able to hammer away on the other side and say, they're the problem. Oh my gosh, all people who are immigrating here without proper papers are the problem. Or the problem is the right wing is terrible because of this or that. There is a middle ground that is rational, that's achievable. We've shown it in the past, over the centuries here, even in the United States. We simply have parties who refuse to meet in the middle and do something that's rational for the American people.
Well, let's talk about another issue. Immigration is driving folks. Also, the issue of democracy is driving some folks. We saw this week Liz Cheney out campaigning with Kamala Harris. There was talk about January 6th at the VP debate. We heard more from Jack Smith about what Donald Trump did in the months following the election last time. Ethan, do you believe, as some Democrats say, that democracy is on the ballot?
Yeah, I think it is, because Donald Trump himself in recent rallies has even said, I only want loyalists. Loyalists as federal bureaucrats is the opposite of democracy. Literally running thousands and tens of thousands of people out of the VA, which he bragged about in speeches more than once now, this has been discussed, that they literally will run out people under the guise of them not doing their job because they're not loyalists. That is anti-democracy, literally stacking and staffing everything into your favor exclusively based on loyalty. Again, no Republican before Donald Trump talked about loyalty the way that he is. That is not democracy. You don't swear allegiance to a person. You swear allegiance. I have taken the oath multiple times as an attorney in the United States Army, among many other places. I take an oath in allegiance to my country and our Constitution, not to a person.
In fairness, Richard Nixon talked about loyalty some, but he ended up resigning because of that. Tommy, let's talk, though, about this issue for voters that may be in the middle, but that are concerned with the way that Donald Trump acted following his loss last time and are concerned what he might do again.
Listen, I first want to say this. I understand that for some folks out there, January 6th is going to replay in their minds every single day. And I would argue that's a very privileged place to be in. If you're casting your vote in November based on January 6th, you are a very privileged person and you probably don't have to worry about groceries. You probably don't have to worry about national security, domestic security, security in your own neighborhoods and the crime that's overrun so many communities. If you wake up every day and you think about that one day on January 6th, well, congratulations, because you're living pretty high on the hog. Most Americans don't have the luxury of talking about democracy and January 6th as their most important issue. But I will say this, I've long acknowledged January 6th was a bad day. On January 6th, I went on all of my social media, as Donald Trump did, and I said, no, this is not the way. We don't believe in doing this. This is not what my party represents. So I have often conceded that January 6th was a horrible day. But I will also say this, and J.D. Vance brought this up in the debate. When you had Hillary Clinton, who is still out there complaining about an election loss, I think it's pretty rich to say that this is a one-sided complaint about election rigging or voter fraud. It's not. This has long been a discussion, and it's been on the left, and it's been on the right. We need to have election integrity. We need to make sure we have voter ID so our elections are safe and secure. Those are things that I care about. I understand that the left wants this issue to be about Donald Trump and what he says in January 6th, but the honest to goodness truth is most Americans are not privileged enough to think about January 6th every day. They're worried about the economy, they're worried about inflation, and they're worried about the world being on fire under Biden-Harris.
But look, January 6th is the first time in the entire history of the United States of America since its founding that there was not a peaceful transition of power from one presidency to the next. Second, I absolutely reject and refute your point regarding Donald Trump. I appreciate you going on your social media the way that you did. Donald Trump did not. That's actually part of Jack Smith's filing this week that shows that Donald Trump did the opposite. He intentionally did not. All the staff members left, according to the Jack Smith filing, and Trump was alone and was asked repeatedly by members of his staff to do something about it, and he refused. It was only until after it was done that Donald Trump bothered to tweet something.
And Tommy, to the point about Hillary Clinton, because this is something that J.D. Vance brought up, how is it the same? Hillary Clinton, the day after the election, went out and conceded the election on camera and then attended Donald Trump's inauguration. Donald Trump has still not conceded the election and did not attend Joe Biden's inauguration. How is it the same?
Well, listen, I don't think anybody can dispute Russia, 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 the Steele dossier, and Hillary Clinton saying that the election was rigged by the Russians. I mean, we know that that was her song and dance. But I'll also say Donald Trump did relinquish power.
Well, that was the song and dance of the Intelligence Committee, wasn't it?
The United States Senate said that, yes.
Is that the same thing as the 51 intelligence officials that said that Hunter Biden's laptop was Russian disinformation? Listen, I understand that for the left, the talking point about January 6th and Project 2025, I understand that it's effective when you have nothing else to talk about. I've already told you it was a bad day. I wish that Donald Trump would go out and say, listen, I'm going to challenge the election in the legal pathways that are available to me, but I will not stage an insurrection. I will never do that. It was a bad day. I admit it was a bad day, but I'd also like to point out that Donald Trump did call for National Guard, and his request for National Guard or his offering of National Guard was rejected. So there's a lot of things that happened on that day that we'll probably never get the truth to. But I would again say, I can tell you January 6th was a bad day. I can also tell you that the average American out there that's struggling to afford eggs and gas probably doesn't wake up every day and think about the do's and don'ts of January 6th. That's just not where we are. And I would encourage you to move forward if you want to win an election.
But Tommy, J.D. Vance in the debate just denied is saying he will not acknowledge that Joe Biden won the 2020 election. Do you acknowledge that Joe Biden won the 2020 election? We're heading into the 2024 election. Did he not win?
I understand, and I have not contested that. So I'm not going to be the person that's going to say that, oh, there was the insurmountable voter fraud. I'm not saying that to you. But what I'm telling you is for a party that wants to move forward and look forward, I understand you're saying, well, they're not saying this or not saying that. I'm not going to argue with you on that. But I'm telling you the issues that matter to the American people are the economy, their crime, and their immigration. Yeah. So if your only message is democracy, 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 have at it. But you're losing a lot of the American people that have far bigger concerns to worry about.
From a polling perspective, Tommy, you are absolutely right, which is part of the reason why Kamala Harris moved away from a lot of that conversation when she took over for Joe Biden, because there was an acknowledgement that the polling shows exactly what you're saying. Real quickly, VP debate this week. Does it matter? Tommy, does it change anything?
So I think it matters. And I was somebody when Donald Trump first picked J.D. Vance. I wasn't thrilled with that pick. I had hoped he had picked somebody else. I was really pulling for a Marco Rubio. But I'll tell you, J.D. Vance performed excellently at that debate. He did a great job of not only coming across as relatable, but also in some points being willing to concede to other ideas and other points. And I thought that he came across as likable because J.D. Vance has had a hard time with women because of some of his past comments about childless cat ladies, comments that I, too, have not, you know, been happy with. So I think that he did come across very relatable. I think talking about his family and how successful his wife is, I think he came across as a supportive husband and father, and I think he handled himself pretty well. Tim Walz on the other side, I don't know, and I don't think Ethan could tell us that Tim Walz had a great night on Tuesday night. Maybe he will, but I think it's pretty obvious, and the polls tell us that J.D. Vance won that debate.
Yeah, I don't think the VP debate matters. I never have since Lloyd Benson destroyed Dan Quayle back in like 1988. It's not important. The key is they're both VP candidates. They were picked. The parties are behind them. And J.D. Vance still has trouble telling the truth.
Do you agree with Tommy that J.D. Vance won that debate?
I think he did a better job than Tim Walz. And going into it, Tim Walz himself even said, I'm not a good debater, and he's not.
All right, real quickly, concise final statement. Why Harris? Ethan, start with you.
Well, I mean, just it's very simple. She looks out for everybody, not just her supporters. She won't punish Republicans, unlike Trump punishing the blue states. I'm all in for Kamala Harris.
Tommy, last word to you.
I also want to say this. Ethan has been on my show before Kamala Harris became the top of the ticket, and he didn't have great things to say about Kamala Harris. I don't think Kamala was Ethan's first, second, or third choice, but we'll just say that's what you've got, so I know you've got to deal with it.
Well, in fairness, Donald Trump was not your first choice either. You came on the show the last time you guys were together pushing for DeSantis, saying how much better he would be as a candidate, right?
Oh, I told you it would be easier to elect Ron DeSantis, and I believe that it probably would have been easier for Republicans to score a victory with Ron DeSantis. I still love Donald Trump, but strategically, obviously, Donald Trump comes with a lot of baggage. I know that. Everybody knows that, right? But I'm telling you this. Right now, to me, not only the issue of immigration, which we talked about extensively, but also of the economy. If you are happy with the way things have been for the last 4 years, then by all means, vote for Kamala Harris. But if you think we can do better and you'd like to go back to 2018 or 2019, then the choice is pretty simple. Donald Trump's your guy.
Well, it is great to see both of you, and we appreciate the fact that we have an actual civil debate about issues that matter. So many shows these days only show one side, and it's nice to be able to hear from really smart people who are respectful to each other. Ethan, Tommy, thank you so much.
Our thanks to Tommy and Ethan. Now to a very, very different topic, talking about anti-Semitism as we approach the anniversary of October 7th, and a really moving film. Take a listen to a clip from that and then more about it.
I knew that something bad is gonna happen.
The documentary Screams Before Silence profiles sexual violence during Hamas's attack on Israel on October 7th and beyond.
He came towards me and just pointed the gun really hard at my forehead.
The screaming and we got shot.
Then silence.
Sheryl Sandberg arrived in Israel to bear witness. For 14 years, she served as COO at Facebook and wrote the number one best-selling book, Lean In, focused on empowering women.
A year ago, I was not this active at all.
Sandberg says October 7th changed her.
This is the most important work of my life. And maybe everything I've done has led to this moment.
Hi. Okay. Hi, how are you?
We met up with Sandberg at the Museum of Tolerance, where she hosted a screening of the film.
Sheryl Sandberg, welcome to The Issue Is, and thank you so much for making this film.
Thank you for having me and for the attention you're bringing to this. I'm super grateful.
And it's, you know, a sobering place where we are right now, the Museum of Tolerance. You look around us, and Anne Frank's image here, and there was so much silence during that period. And you think of this, Screams Before Silence, which that title has a lot of meanings, it seems like. What does that title mean to you?
I mean, that title is, I think, two things. One is literally about people who were sexually assaulted and raped and then killed. Most of the victims of Hamas's brutal sexual assault and violence on October 7th have died. They were killed. Mm. And so it is their literal screams before silence. But I think it's also the screams before the silence, and worse, lack of belief that this happened.
And why it's so important to get the word out there. And for you, you have built up this extraordinary platform through so much hard work. You could pick any topic to be the thing that you're shining a light on. Why this topic? Why was this so personal for you?
Because I think so many years after we taught everyone they needed to believe women, and I was part of that, and really, like, we have to believe women. The politics of our time are so polarizing that people are turning a blind eye to something that has to always be true. This is a humanitarian crisis on all sides. War is never acceptable, but no matter what you believe should happen in the Middle East or anywhere else, sexual violence should never be used as a tool of war, and we must all speak out wherever it occurs, and that's why I made this.
And one of the big takeaways from this is that this was the strategy. It was not only let's get in there, let's kill people, but raping people was part of the plan.
Correct. And what this film gives people an opportunity to do is not to hear it from you, not to hear it from me, we were not there, but to hear it directly from the eyewitnesses, and importantly, mostly eyewitnesses to what they saw on dead bodies, because most of the victims were killed. And that makes this very different than many situations. But there's one thing that's not different, which is that we have to stand united against any time sexual violence is used as a tool of war.
You're there with them as they relive this. How does that experience change you?
It's hard, but it's so much less hard for me than for them. I mean, you walk with released hostages into their home. It's all in this film. Sorry, where like father and husband was killed, sister was killed, taken. These are peace-loving people living in a kibbutzim on the border because they believe in peace with their neighbors. You sit there and you listen to, or you stood, I guess, grown men crying. Mm-hmm. Grown men, these huge men, they tower above. I mean, you are fairly tall too, yeah. But this guy towers above me, and mm-hmm. he is looking at trees and crying because those were the trees where he saw bodies naked, sorry for the, but bloodied.
That's
this is what this is.
That's what we have to talk about.
And he's crying because he didn't save enough of them, even though he saved many. This is something the world can't stand for, and we have to understand that this is terrorism. Terrorism by people who absolutely say they want to end Israel. Mm-hmm. They want death to Jews. They want death to America. Mm-hmm. They want death to our values. This is not just about the Israelis and people of other nationalities, including Americans who are harmed and taken captive on October 7th. This is about a threat to our values, and we have to fight against that terrorism.
Well, I know as an interviewer, sometimes you're supposed to remain somewhat dispassionate, but it looked like there were several moments where you put your arm out or gave them a hug or felt their humanity and wanted to be there for them. I mean, what was that like for you?
I tried, you know, to be there and understand, be there and make sure they knew they weren't alone and thank them for what they had gone through and for the bravery to share their story so we can all stand against this.
How has this film has been out now for several months, been seen by millions of people, over a million views on YouTube. What does that reaction mean to you? And talk about what you're hearing back from people.
Well, I'm grateful that we were able to put it on YouTube so it can be viewed for free by anyone. What I hear over and over again is, thank you. I didn't know this happened. I didn't believe it happened, but it's just, you can't refute it when you hear it directly from these people. So I'm hoping more people watch so that we can fight this together.
Yeah. You're just at this museum of tolerance, which has looked through the history of anti-Semitism for so many generations, thousands of years, really. How do you put this moment in historical context? And what does being here amongst all of this while seeing this, how is that something you're thinking about?
It's such a good question. In my lifetime, I'm 55 years old, I thought anti-Semitism was largely a thing of the past. Stories my parents and grandparents told me, my great-grandparents fleeing from Europe pre-World War II, as so many did. I'm lucky they did. But I don't think that's true anymore. I think the anti-Semitism is real. I just dropped one of my children off in college and walked. It was like the parent fair for all the stuff for the parents to see. And there was a booth that said safety and security for Jewish students. A year ago today, because we're not yet at October 7th, if you had told me I was going to drop my kid off at college and I would walk past that booth with a line of people there to find out how to keep their kids safe, I would have thought you were crazy. But that is the reality for our kids. And that's unacceptable. We have to fight hate, intolerance in all of its forms, including anti-Semitism.
Well, this helps to do it by shining a light on what's really happening. Thank you for making it, and thanks for all the work that you do.
Thank you. Thank you for this.
Really appreciate it.
Watch the full documentary for free anytime. Search for Screams Before Silence on YouTube.
Congratulations. Congratulations.
1 year ago this week, LaFonza Butler was sworn in to represent California in the U.S. Senate and replace the late Dianne Feinstein. We joined the senator on her one-year anniversary for an exclusive interview during a special service project.
Ladies and gentlemen, U.S. Senator LaFonza Butler.
LaFonza Butler is the first U.S. senator to visit Project Angel Food. She's quickly put to work, volunteering in the kitchen next to me.
I have tried to live my life in service, Alex.
This kitchen, making over 3,500 meals a day for SoCal's sick and hungry, powered largely by volunteers.
When I was on the board of the Children's Defense Fund, Marion Wright Edelman said to me that service is the rent we pay for living.
Project Angel Food CEO Richard Ayoub recently met Butler at an event and told her about the work. In 35 years, they've served over 18 million meals.
We do medically tailored meals. So if someone has diabetes, our meals help bring down their A1C levels. Everything is geared toward the illness and grounded in research.
The center making tofu meals for those battling heart disease.
Well, my father died when I was 15 years old. And my father died of congestive heart disease. And I think about whether or not, you know, my dad maybe would have lived longer if he had access to the healthy kinds of food.
What's your bottom line message to people that are watching this?
Pay your rent. Pay your rent. Whether that is with money that you have or time that you have, these folks need our help, they need our support, and the people that they serve need to know that their neighbors care about them.
They do such great work. If you'd like to donate or volunteer for Project Angel Food, head to angelfood.org. Up next, The Issue Is, featured on The Late Show. Stay with us. One word reaction to the debate tonight, Lisa.
Respectful, surprisingly so.
John.
Civilized.
Civilized. We like that. Maybe we'll see that with you two as well tonight. This week, we hosted a bonus edition of The Issue Is right after the VP debate with John Cobalt, Lisa Bloom, and also Melanie Mason. Thanks to everyone who watched, including, apparently, Stephen Colbert and his team from CBS's The Late Show.
This felt like almost like going back into the past of like, this is what VP debates sort of felt like in the normal times.
Hey. You know what's not normal? Celebrating how normal something is. Our special tonight is a perfectly normal, nothing to see here piece of chicken that is definitely not the chef's foot that fell into a pot. It's served on a bed of Dr. Scholl's. Bon appetit.
If you want to watch that debate show, you can do so right now at youtube.com/AlexMichelson. Thanks so much for listening to this podcast. We'll be back next week, including a conversation about one of the closest congressional races that we're watching. Will Rollins challenging Republican Congressman Ken Calvert. We will talk to both of them next week here on The Issue Is. I'm Alex Michelson. Thanks for listening.